Hey, got the morning show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Rick Thorpe. Morning, Rick.
Morning, Aaron. Atamari Whangaroa.
So
beautiful day.
I used to introduce you as it's Rick from Extreme Zero Waste.
No,
you're not on staff, but you are on the board thing there. I say thing because I'm not quite sure how that all works anymore.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, always connected to the program. I think you know it's always been a big part of my life, not involved in the day-to-day. They've got way better people to manage the system. Steve's doing such an awesome job.
All right. So, but Extreme has a – could you change the structure? It was just an incorporated society like we here are at the radio station, but now there's a bigger body being created.
Yeah, it's that's right. And the incorporated society was kind of like a membership organization, which was appropriate in those early years because it was made by the community for the community to resolve a community issue. And so the membership approach was the best one. But now it's a trust. And so there's a mother trust, and then underneath that is a limited liability company with charitable status, which is Extreme Zero Waste Activities. And there's a new limited liability company being set up underneath the same mother trust called Community Energy Whangaroa.
Yes.
And that'd be great to come and have a chat about that in a couple of weeks' time. So very, very exciting progress with that project.
Okay, and we just had Jasmine from the Environment Centre in here 2 days ago.
Cool.
Talking about the merge of Extreme and the Environment Centre. So they're just becoming part of Extreme, not becoming another entity under the mothership.
No, that's right. Yeah, and of course, you know, the WEC, if we were to call it a brand, you know, is very strong.
Yeah,
and they're also, you know, the pioneers of plastic-free Raglan. So that's another brand. And so these brands, you know, will stay unique and part of kind of Extreme. But in many cases, we've got so many community groups in Whangaroa that it's really hard to find enough directors and the type of and expect them to be voluntary. And so for some organisations, it was about importing those people from other communities, Hamilton and Cambridge. So it was kind of in recognition that a lot of the activity between WEC and Extreme was similar. And
well, you worked on projects together, quite a few projects together,
heaps.
I noticed.
Yep.
And like the plastic free, I'm not sure whether that was a WEC project or an Extreme project, or I think it shifted around.
Yeah.
So, All right, so that's cool. That's a little bit of a different angle on that than we talked about.
Mm.
But you did a few weeks ago a talk on the circular economy. And my takeaway from what is a circular economy is that it's just common sense.
I'm going with that.
I know that doesn't actually explain it to listeners what that means. You can do that, but to me that feels like what it is.
That's right. And I think for those of us with bit of age, we remember things quality being the big issue.
Oh yeah.
And repairability being a big issue. And so those concepts are sort of bound into this new pattern of words, circular economy, and it's in a kind of a movement, I guess, internationally that a recognition that that's where we must move if we're to reduce emissions, and so circular economy is about reducing the use of natural resources. So again, talking about quality, repairability, but also if at the end of the life of that product, being able to deconstruct it and utilize all of those resources again. So that's the circular model opposed to the linear one, which is about just taking natural resources, making something, and then burying it in the landfill.
Yeah.
And then having to go back once again and doing the extraction. And the reality is we just don't have enough natural resources to keep that linear system going. So we've got to move to a circular.
It's a change of the way we think, but also is it a change of the infrastructure in our the technological side of our culture? Like, how hard is it to do? How hard is it to do?
Well, it's not. You know, if I was to reflect back, I can remember, you know, the family toaster breaking and my dad going, sweet as, I'll take it with me. You know, on the commuter train in Wellington, and drop it off because there's a dude who's just got a kind of like a hole in the wall set up, and that's what he does. He repairs toasters and puts new elements in. It up in the evening on the way home. So many people were involved in repair, and. You know, another example would be around upholstery and the ability to build a couch and repair a couch, change the textile on the couch, you know. And so you would buy something that had a really strong frame and would last for decades, maybe even generations, but you have the opportunity to repair it or recover it. And so those upholsterers, and we've got some amazing retired upholsterers in this town, but that's just an example. You know, it's there's a whole raft of employment opportunities with repair.
So one of the things that happened with repairing is I remember the last time I tried to get something repaired was probably 15 years ago or more, and the person doing the repairing was like, well, look, you know, it's going to cost this much for me to do it, or you could just buy a new one for the same.
Yes.
We've still got that. We've still got things being made, mass-produced cheaply because they're crap is one of the reasons they're so cheap, but also we've got better systems for making things cheaply. What's the way around that? Is that easy to answer right now? Is that up to someone in that particular each industry to work that out?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and I guess at some stage through legislation, policy, we provided the opportunity for commerce, the corporates, to be able to get rid of their parts division and their service division and just focus on marketing and manufacture. And at that point, everything changed because then all of the competitors went to that model as well, which obviously is a greater profit model.
Yeah.
And so you build things that don't really last, and you provide excuses such as, well, this is about technology is changing so rapidly that we need to be able to, the next model will have so many other features. But the reality, it was just a profit model around getting rid of service division, parts division, and just telling people that they needed to replace it because it was cheaper. So we've got to get back. And there's legislation coming out throughout the world, and New Zealand government considering it as well, around repairability. And so if you want to be a manufacturer or an importer, you actually have to construct for deconstruction and construct for repairing.
Yeah, and there's been quite a movement in the US in the tech, well, not the tech industry, but the tech fanboys really, who want to be able to repair their own stuff. And it is a movement I've seen, you know, the people talking about North America, and just stop building technologies in ways that prevents you from repairing it.
Yep.
And Apple's like keeps getting named as one of the worst offenders
That,
you know.
Like my phone.
I mean, you couldn't do anything with that.
Well, it's
and they make it difficult to repair, and they kind of been forced to do a few things, but they've done it grudgingly and as badly as possible from the reports I'm seeing, but at least it's heading in the right direction again.
Yeah, I agree. And there are many corporates who are making a decision that they want to be part of that. They're not waiting for the policy and legislative changes. They're actually leading through ethics and deciding that their values are actually about a circular economy. And I'd have to say that many of those are, they're, you know, there's a couple that I work with up in Auckland, and those people have inherited the business from their father and their grandfather. But this new generation is going, actually, you know, for the sake of our kids, we want to actually make a big change.
That's what I say at the start, it's just common sense.
Yeah.
And the younger generation's like, yeah, of course we're going to do that. Yeah. But not everybody, but...
No. and they're predominantly women, I'd have to say.
Okay. All right. Thinking ahead. So now, in your talk you did, and you mentioned this before off the air, percentage of the economy that needs to be circular. My note says Christ, but that can't be right. I scribble notes very quickly on the note thing on my phone, and so it's just guessing a lot of words. Tell me the thing you were telling me off the air.
That's great. I love it.
Yeah, it's a message from Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you should, it should be a circular economy.
Go for that. Yeah, well, look, we're probably sitting around something like 5 to 7% circular.
So that means we make stuff, and at the end of its life, 5 to 7% of the stuff that's been made can be reused again.
Yeah, but more than that, there's been some design philosophy right up front to say we want to extract less natural resources, we want to make it less toxic, and then from that point on, it's about the design of the actual product. And then from there, how do we capture the product at the end of its life and ensure that all of the, as much of the natural resources are captured again for reuse? So that's the Climate Change Commission produces these emissions reduction plans, which are guiding New Zealand government towards a reduction in emissions, but also a more circular economy. And so they have the ability to measure that, and they say that we're sitting around 5 to 7% at the moment. But if we achieve 15 to 18%, then we'll actually reach all of our emissions reduction and climate change targets, which is a great thing.
That makes it sound easier than previously we've been told. We get a lot of doom and gloom around this area, and I feel it's a little bit debilitating for people. It just kind of destroys hope. But
yeah,
that's a little bit more of a hopeful perspective.
Yeah, I think it's exciting. Let's bring back a world of quality and repair and build some jobs around it and be proud of our products, you know, that we're going to pass on for generations, you know, or make them in a modular way so that if something on your washing machine breaks, you know, then you can either buy that module, that part online, or your service provider can just come in and replace it. The world I want to live in.
And there's a group of people making laptops now that are purposely to be modular. Because laptops are like the least modular thing you could think of, you know, compared to like desktop computers and what have you, although the phone's probably worse. But yeah, they're working on doing that. Now, I can't remember their name, otherwise I'd tell people what it was. I've just seen it online. Now, there was a concept you were talking about too, about renting rather than owning. And there's multiple issues around this, and some people might not like it because the software industry wants to take us to a renting rather than an owning model, and that's for their profit and benefit, not for ours. But this was a bit of my mind was a little bit blown at the possibilities of this for equipment. So if the company continues to own a piece of machinery rather than you own it, it becomes in their best interest to make a high quality machine that's going to last and be indestructible.
Yeah.
And that was, and then I imagined that rolled out around all the stuff that we have.
Yeah.
And that could, I don't know how it would happen, but just as a concept, I thought that's quite powerful.
Yeah, and I guess we've got some old examples of that, of the sharing, and we also have some new ones. An example of an old one would be the library. You just become a member, and you get access to all of those books. We don't all have to own all of those books.
And you see what libraries do. As soon as they get a book, they make it tougher.
Yeah.
You know, they put some stuff on it to make sure it doesn't fray around the edges and things like that.
True.
So, yeah.
So, and we've got some other great examples. There's a tool library, which is run by Whangarau Environment Centre. There's toy libraries run by some of the parent groups.
Yeah, the community house has one in their basement every week, so right. Start of the week, yeah.
So those are great opportunities. You know, you don't have to own everything. Leasing is becoming a big thing. And in Europe, it's very common for if you're a business, you would lease the soft furnishings, you know, the carpets, the drapes, if you had them.
Cars, a lot of businesses lease their cars.
Yeah. So you don't need to own it. And you're right, you know, if the manufacturer becomes not only a product seller but a service seller, then they will build things that are more robust.
Profoundly different. Yeah, it would be profoundly different. Young people don't probably remember what it was like when things were made to last. Yeah. I barely remember, you know.
My mum's hot water cylinder crapped out the other day, and so she replaced it. And I was asking her, how long has it been? And she said, oh, well, we put it in when we built the house. Well, that was about 65 years ago. And the hot water cylinder, and I got it to keep it, and I took the cover off it, and the copper in it is like about 3 millimeters thick, you know. Yeah. And yes, it had a new element, you know, probably every 5 to 10 years, but you know, it lasted for that time,
and it didn't leak.
Yeah,
which is actually a real problem in houses. People don't notice their hot water cylinder is leaking, and it damages the house. That yeah. rots the timber around. Yeah, so yeah,
and so much thinner in the walls, and then they become susceptible to acid rain, you know, and different water qualities.
Oh, really? So, do we have acid rain here?
Oh, I would presume so. I mean, some people who might be on rainwater and or you know, aquifer water, it might have issues with alkaline or acidity.
Okay, all right, just stuff in the water. So, still on this topic, but jumping around a bit, I interviewed Phil McCabe about seabed mining on Wednesday.
Oh, big ups, Phil.
Yeah, and they want to get more minerals. We have to get more minerals for industry.
Yeah.
We have to get it out of the sea. That's where it is. And besides which, it doesn't really do any damage anyway. That's the message.
Yeah,
I'm paraphrasing a little. The TTR's PR people might not like the way I've put it, but their chair of their organisation has actually tried to say that it doesn't really do any damage. But I think you would say, and we just mentioned this off the air, that instead of mining the seabed, we could mine old rubbish dumps.
Yeah, for sure, and
avoid putting things there in the first place. But yeah. Let's talk about this.
Yeah, and there has been landfills in Aotearoa that have been mined for their metals, and one in particular was at Kawarau, and it was full of old forestry equipment. So the volume of metal in that landfill, and probably the absence of kind of, you know, domestic waste, industrial waste, meant that it was safe enough to do. But the reality is, yeah, we produce so much metals and a whole range these days. I mean, cell phones, laptops have got a whole variety of metals in the motherboards. And let's develop systems for recovering that and utilising as much as we can. If there's then a need for more, then let's have that conversation. But at the moment, all of the metal which is brought up to extreme zero waste has already had the environmental damage done. It's already been extracted from the ground and someone else's land and transported halfway around the world, et cetera, so.
So we've got, we all know we can recycle our aluminium and tin cans. If you bring some old corrugated iron up to the recycle centre, that can be reused again, or if it's in little pieces that are no use to anyone, it can go into the big bin to be taken off to be, I guess, melted back down and reused. So quite a lot of that's happening already. It has been diverted. I guess if someone pulls apart a building and it's got big I-beams in it, metal I-beams, they can be used again. Hopefully people aren't burying those anymore.
Yeah.
But are they?
You know, like some there's might be. Yeah, construction and demolitions, they call them clean fills around the country where they're supposed to do maximum extraction, but the legislation's changing to make them more accountable. But it is difficult. I would say that still a lot of metal is going into landfills. All of those things. I mean, Extreme Zero Waste would use the waste hierarchy, and so when metal comes in, they would look at that sheet of iron, for example, and say, can we just trim up the edge of it? And actually, there's some usable linear length of roofing iron there for a project at home, for a goat, house or a dog kennel or whatever.
Yeah.
And linear lengths of other metal are all racked up. So reuse being the important one because of all the embodied energy already in that thing.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, if it's too rusty, if it can't be used for anything, then yes, recycling is the next option.
Yeah, because that's energy intensive, of course. Not like extraction is, but certainly more so, much more than reuse.
And so much of our metal heads off overseas. You know, the Chinese market in particular is the one that really sets the price globally for metals. And so it will go up and down. Sometimes Extreme needs to charge for things, particularly around whiteware, because of the large plastic content, which does go to landfill. But also it's at some stages in the history of Extreme, it's actually cost us more money to collect and transport the metal to market. And then other times, you know, it makes a higher premium and makes a profit. But it's very difficult because it's not stable. And this is part of the circular economy project as well, of let's actually localize things as much as we can. If those resources have been imported into this country, let's extract as many uses out of them before they reach the end of their life, and don't be in a hurry to export it when we've already got a need for it here.
So we're probably doing reasonably well with recycling, reusing the metal in this country that we do have, because it's a pretty obvious one and most people know they can get a bit of cash for it. But is there metal that we're missing out on that has not yet been diverted? Diverted from landfill?
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of motherboards and things are an important one.
Yeah, because the metal's like in little bitty bits through it, isn't it?
And such a variety.
And it's the cost-effectiveness issue there.
Well,
is it worth doing?
I think probably they're not valued as much as they should be at the moment, but they will be in the future. I would say that it's better to actually bank those materials for the future.
Yeah,
and put all of the motherboards, you know, in a sea freight container, and those metals are precious, and there's not many deposits left of some of them, so. So their value will increase for the future.
We got people walking past the studio. It's a busy town. Now, someone asked me a question. Hold on. The question came through. Do you know about the worldwide sand shortage for cement mix? I just saw a picture of the Sahara the other day. There's plenty of sand.
Plenty of sand. I think it's like one of the, next to water, it's one of the biggest traded commodities in the world, sand, because of our obsession with concrete and glass.
We love our concrete. I just saw somebody put a concrete driveway in yesterday, just talking to them, and it was a relief after what they had, which was a little bit of gravel on a steep slope, and cars were getting stuck, and the cars were having to be pulled out of their section.
Yeah.
So it does, you can see why people like it.
Yeah.
But you don't have much at your place.
Concrete, no. Yeah. And, you know, I guess Auckland Council are definitely considering this. You know, it becomes an impervious surface. There's no absorption of excess water.
Oh, yeah, then you've got other problems.
So storm issues. And big ups to Waikato District Council, the Bankart Street ones. I love those kind of rain garden.
Oh, yeah, approaches. They're working on that now. Cool. Yeah. I've just been told you can't use the desert sand from the Sahara. It's the wrong shape.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Can't we work out a way to use that? What's going on?
I think some of these Sahara sands were used for glass, because I can remember Fonterra sending all of the sea freight containers, obviously full of dairy product, over to Saudi and And then they were having the clear little alcohol bottles produced there and come back in the sea freight containers.
Okay, yeah.
And then they were using the milk whey for producing alcohol, which used to be for industrial purposes, but was then turned into alco pops, you know, those sort of...
Okay, yeah, well, anyway, I don't think we have much of an answer about... if we had a worldwide shortage of cement, what would you do, Rick? Like, it must be one of the biggest products. It's probably the biggest thing. If you name a product, yeah, it's probably the biggest product that most the world produces.
Yeah, and kind of, like, there's some changes in legislation which are coming out around emissions of building. And so if you want a concrete, there'll be a maximum amount of emissions for a domestic house. And so if you want a concrete floor, then that's going to use up X amount of your emissions. And so, yeah, I just think that we have to rethink so many things. You know,
I want to argue with that one, but make that debate evolve a bit more, because if you design your house for the sun, the concrete slab is going to help heat your house.
Yep,
and you won't have to use electricity or firewood to heat your house as much. Yep. And I've actually done this. This used to be what I did.
Yep.
You can design a house in New Zealand to not use heaters at all.
For sure.
If you do it properly. Yeah, it is possible. And in which case, I'm hoping that this thing you're talking about puts that calculation over, you know, how many years. If you use a lot of concrete, but the concrete house is there or the floor is there for a very long time, then it kind of pays for itself in terms of emissions.
For sure. And, yeah, I mean, passive solar is a great...
That's the phrase.
..great way to, you know, design a house. But so many of the sections are all south-facing and so don't have, you know, the ability to... Or the houses of your neighbours are only 1 metre from the boundary and therefore cast a shadow.
It's still possible, but people aren't even trying. They're not even facing to the north sometimes, surprisingly, because that makes the house nicer anyway.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
Yeah, it hasn't really filtered into the industry as something that's standard or anything like that.
And let's...
Maybe it will.
And keep that conversation going, because that's kind of related to the Community Energy Whangaroa project as well, which really comes back to efficiency and the need to create more energy, because we're designing houses that are inefficient because of the materials. Can we afford to keep building things out of concrete? What a city is all about. I think COVID was a real wake-up for many of those businesses, where they found that they were as efficient, if not more efficient, actually, with their workers working from home rather than a tall, multi-level building in the CBD, you know. And so do we actually need as many of those buildings as we once did? What is the future?
Yeah, lots of discussion. Okay, so have you got anything else you want to say about circular economy?
I just want to say, you know, that down at the pub on the science night, and Jasmine did an amazing job and filled the room with people. I'm sure it wasn't my subject that bought them. Maybe it was the beer, actually. but wouldn't it be good at the pub to actually get workshop brewery beer? Just saying. Anyway. And it was so cool to see so many of our businesses, and there's that sort of kind of feel and whangaroa that we're not actually going to wait for permission to behave in this way or change our behaviour and to be more circular. And just a big shout out, big mihi to Dreamview, Workshop Brewery, our local businesses, and Raglan Chocolate, who really put the effort in and try, and they look at their input resources and their product and their packaging and go to such creative lengths to try and minimise these negative impacts, maximise the positive aspects of their product.
So we've
got such a creative business community here, and I feel that it bodes well for the future.
And the interesting thing, or a key thing about it, and a key thing is the community as well, because like Dreamview and Workshop still need the customers and our community to participate in the process. So like Workshop Brewery wants to make the can holders recyclable, but we still have to do the right thing with it. We can't just chuck it in the rubbish.
Yeah.
And the same goes with Dreamview's bottles. We still want to clean them.
Yep.
My daughter, Edie, worked for them for a while, and I helped her unload the truck one day, and I think she'd been to Hamilton.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping it was a Hamilton delivery, and some of them were scungy. They were pretty vile. Yeah, they were nasty. So, yeah, we've got to help. You know, that's part of the deal as a citizen of the planet, I guess, is that we've got to participate as well.
Yeah, and I guess for me, the last thing is, you know, support those services that we talked about, the sharing ones around toy libraries, book libraries, tool libraries. There's Time Bank as well, really important one. So if you've got skills that you want to share, then that's a wonderful place to go.
Yeah, and the Environment Centre starting up the Repair Cafe as well at the moment. That's just, so I think they've just hired Jess to work for that. And they're just getting organised. And if there's people out there who are good at repairing things, they got a bit of time, get in touch with the Environment Centre and bring that back. So what about the other work you do? You do a fair bit of consultancy work for Auckland Council who are trying to recycle. Oh, have you heard about what's happening down in Gore?
No.
A lot of people have heard that there's a 23-year-old mayor and a much older chief executive, and they're not getting on down there. And I saw a little bit of stuff. Apparently last year with the previous mayor, they got rid of their curbside collection because it was too expensive for the ratepayers, which is a debate that we had 20, 25 years ago in this community and had been resolved. But down there at the moment, there's these two 90-year-old guys who are doing the recycling at Gore, and they've got a team of their mates who are all 70 or 80 years old. Wow. And they're bringing in $100,000 of just doing recycling. So that's the Lions Club, just like here.
Yep.
25 years ago, it was the Lions Club was doing the recycling.
Cardboard. Yeah. Yep.
So that's what's still happening down in Gore. Mm. A generation later, they haven't quite caught up with us.
Gee.
But there's been protests and there's all sorts of stuff. Quiet Gore is suddenly in the national spotlight. Anyway, but that's an aside. What is Auckland Council is looking to do things? They're looking to, or they are putting in community recycle centres, aren't they? And they've put in several already.
Yep. Yeah, so they've got a plan to be zero waste by 2040, which is an ambitious goal. But the resource recovery centres. The community recycle centres, community resource recovery centres, and some of them are even calling themselves community resilience centres, especially after all of the storm events that have taken place.
Yeah.
And so they've taken on this kind of, ability to care for their local community and resources out. And so Auckland Council is keen to develop 21 of these resource recovery centres. And currently they have 12, and we're just working on the bundled procurement for the next lot. And these resource recovery centres are starting to trade with each other and share resources.
Interesting, yeah.
And share markets. And their collective value is so much greater. You know, it's of a volume that they can command a better price.
There's that networking capacity that Extreme hasn't really had because we're out here on the coast by ourselves. So
yeah, we've been keen for some years to establish resource recovery centres in Huntly, Ngāruawhia, Pōkeno, Cambridge.
I did ask the mayor about that last time I interviewed her, but she really didn't have her finger on the pulse of that. What particular issue, I thought. Yeah,
and if I was part of those communities, I'd be quite upset about what the future holds, because on the one side, the government is increasing the waste levies.
Yeah.
So for every ton of waste sent to landfill, it is now $40 a ton, and it's going to increase to $60 a ton by July 2024.
Yeah.
So another sort of 13 months' time, it'll be $60 a ton plus the gate fee. To take waste. So that's a tool, a kind of a stick, if you like, to try and change behaviour and get people to go, wow, it's becoming really expensive to landfill, so therefore I'll reduce my waste.
Yeah.
But in the communities such as Whangaroa, we have the opportunity to divert up to 80% of our waste stream. So if you do that separation, and if you put in a bit of thought when you purchase things, then you should be able to actually reduce the costs rather than have to pay that waste levy. But the people in Huntly, Ngaro, Wahia, Pōkeno and Cambridge, they have no ability because there's no resource recovery centre for them to divert. So they're just having to pay this large amount of money. So yeah. The two things must go hand in hand.
Yeah, and we know that a commercial recycler won't have the capacity or the ability or desire to divert as much materials from the rubbish as a community recycler.
Yeah.
And they're stuck with a commercial recycler over there at the moment. And yeah. I don't know what their stats are. They probably won't tell us.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, they only really divert product which is profitable, which is, you know, not glass, not metal at the moment, not plastics, not paper, not cardboard.
So what do they do when they get metal then?
Well, they do divert those things because they've got some reverse logistic transport. So when they send their bins to Hampton Downs, you know, then they can move products as well up to Auckland. So
that is kind of happening.
Green Gorilla is a construction demolition company, and they're moving into the Waikato as well and going to set up better diversion. Sims has got a big operation in Hamilton where they sort of amass material and reduce the volume and send it up to Auckland as well. So it's changing. But, yeah, pretty much for a commercial contractor, waste contractor, it is very difficult to make a profit from recyclables.
Because the price jumps around so much. And I know that the history of Extreme Zero Waste is to try to recycle the stuff that's on the borderline. So you will get some money for it, but it's not profitable and it has to be subsidised by the other stuff that's been recycled.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, profit from the shop or profit from things like aluminium, which has always commanded a good premium. Having that basket approach, it pays for the unprofitable things. And glass is a great example. You know, we get $75 a tonne because there's only one place in New Zealand that you can take it to. It probably costs $200 a tonne to actually collect it, colour sort it, hire the containment and transport it to Auckland. That's $75 a tonne delivered to the market.
Yeah.
And if it's unprofitable for Raglan, then imagine what it's going to be like for Gore or Wanaka.
Because we're pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah, and are there still people doing those material recovery facilities and all the recycling goes into the one bin and the one truck and gets crushed up?
Yep, they do. And there's a project which we were part of a couple of years ago called the Standardisation of Curbside Recycling. And that's kind of setting a standard across the country so you always know what you need to put out on the curbside. And it reduces the for example, the type of plastics to 1, 2, and 5. And really that's all we need as a country, 1, 2, and 5.
Which is stop making stuff with all those other numbers.
Don't make 3, 6s, and 7s, just stop making them.
Yeah.
Don't import them, don't manufacture them, we don't need them. And the volumes are too small for us to have a competitive market for.
Yeah, I know you guys used to try to recycle them.
Yeah, well, I mean, we used to do 1 to 7 and be so proud of it. But in fact, some of the feedback from the Whangaroa community is that we were making recycling too easy and therefore people weren't changing their behaviour in terms of consumption and consumerism. So we kind of detuned a bit and went for the standardisation approach and are going to try and stick to that because we actually want those other plastics to not be produced.
Yeah. Okay, what's a different subject? What's happened to the container deposit scheme that was about to come in before the Prime Minister's changed?
Yeah, and it was the Prime Minister's personal view, even though it was supported by 90% of community, 85% of all councils, all businesses, maybe except for Coca-Cola.
which is quite a big business.
But they did actually make a statement the other day when they moved the Sprite bottle from green to clear that they are supportive now of a container return scheme.
I guess they know how it looks.
Yeah.
To not be supportive of that these days.
But we should try hard for that. And we've the Zero Waste Network is working on material to go into the manifestos for all of the political parties. And the one thing that it's calling for is the container return scheme within the first 100 days of being elected.
Yeah.
So let's make it a promise in their manifesto and work towards it, because it's a no-brainer.
So this is for glass bottles. Oh, but also
it's for glass, plastic, and probably aluminium as well. Okay. Cans.
In the old days, you could beverage. Just it was just glass, but
yeah,
that's before we had a lot of plastic anything.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Did we even have plastic in those? Oh, you're too young.
My childhood, yes. But yours, Rick, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think we did. Yeah,
I mean, there was a time.
Yeah,
there wasn't. Yeah. But that changed. Okay, so folks, we're talking to Rick Thorpe and the whole circular economy, recycling world. It's changing. Is it changing fast enough? Are people going to say, oh, it's just recycling a bit of this and that, like the container deposit? We've got bigger fish to fry. I mean, do you have a comment on that? More pressing problems. We've got climate change.
I think, let's just do our own thing and not worry as much about what's happening globally and nationally. We've got everyone's really literate about waste issues, and we've got businesses who really are ethical, value-based. So we don't need permission to act sustainably. And it doesn't have to be an austere future. You know, it could be actually an abundant future. But let's get some of our young people into that design area to design products and packaging that has all of the values of a circular economy.
Yeah, I guess that's a really important message of the circular economy concept, is that it doesn't have to be an austere future. The whole point of being circular is that that you can have abundance. And the natural world is like that. Like, you look at a tree when it produces blossoms in spring, that's overkill. Engineers wouldn't design a tree like that, like thousands of blossoms just going to waste. That's not how, nature does it quite differently. Yeah. All right, Rick, thank you for coming in.
Cool.
And you might have things to say about the community energy group in a few weeks.
We're off to Poihakina to celebrate the start of the project. That's where we initiated the idea, and that's where we would like to go back to before we bring it to the community. So within the next month we'll definitely be celebrating the birth of a new community project around energy.
Awesome. Thanks for coming in, Rick.